I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. There are signs today that the 2018 election is heating up in Pennsylvania. First, Republican nominee Scott Wagner released an attack ad about Governor Tom Wolf. The topic? Education funding, and it had some bold claims about Wolf ripping money away from rural school districts. So is it true? And where did this line of attack come from? Turns out, reporting from Keystone Crossroads is at the center of the story. Reporters Kevin McCrory and Avi Wolfman-Aaron explain how we got here.
All right, Avi, let's go back to the beginning.
Okay, Kevin, so all of this started at a press conference in late June in Philadelphia.
I am proud to stand with all of you to do this really important thing.
Governor Wolf was there to announce more money for lead remediation in some Philly public schools in the wake of damning press reports. Keystone Crossroads was there and asked Wolf if this sort of one-shot emergency funding was evidence that the state should be doing something more consistent for needy districts. And within his answer, he said this.
Yes, we need a fair funding formula for all dollars going into public education.
Keystone Crossroads asked a follow-up question to clarify. So you think all state basic education money should be run through the fair funding formula? Again, here's what Wolf said.
Do I think that? Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
This might sound wonky, but it's a big deal. That formula, made law 2 years ago, takes into account things like poverty rates, tax effort, and current enrollment numbers for each district in the state. The plan has been to only use the formula for new increases in money. But if you use it to dole out all state education funding, it's a massive redistribution that creates clear winners and clear losers.
The biggest winners would be places with significant poverty, steady or growing public school enrollment, and relatively high school taxes. The biggest losers would be districts where enrollment has plummeted, which is the case in much of rural Pennsylvania. There are some people who think this makes sense because it would correct inequities that have grown over time, but it's been thought of as a fringe idea. Until that day, when Wolf said,
"Do I think that? Yes."
Keystone Crossroads ran a story that day about Wolf's remarks, noting that Wolf was calling for a drastic change. But the story made clear that Wolf offered no hard timeline for when that should happen. A few days later, the Wolf camp wanted to clarify the governor's position. Yes, the governor supports all dollars through the formula, but not immediately. The changes would, quote, take time, they said, not giving any specifics. But by that time, Wolf's political opponents seized on what Wolf said in the initial story. They say anything that Wolf says now is a flip-flop, and it's become a full-blown campaign talking point.
Hundreds of our schools would see crippling cuts. Even Democrats are saying Tom Wolf's plan would be immediately devastating. Typical Tom Wolf.
This is from a Scott Wagner campaign ad released this week. There's also a whole website Wagner's campaign made showing how rural schools would be hurt.
Wolf's campaign says this is nonsense. They point out that the governor has consistently stumped for more education funding and gotten it, and say he only supports using the formula completely if there's enough money in the system to make sure that no district gets hurt. Beth Molina is his campaign spokeswoman.
Only when there is full, fair, and adequate funding would he support putting all money through the formula. There currently is not, and there is no timetable for that to happen.
So what exactly does that mean? What is full, fair, and adequate?
That's very debatable. What's not is how much money it would take to drive all dollars through the formula without cutting any district. A Keystone Crossroads analysis of state data says it would take $32 billion new dollars to do that. That's five times what's currently spent. A massive amount of money. And to be clear, Wolf's camp is not calling for that increase. But this fact adds to the sense of how politically and economically difficult it is to use the formula more robustly.
And there's one more twist in this story. Even though Wagner is championing rural Pennsylvania now, back in 2016, he told Keystone Crossroads that the state was wrong to favor shrinking districts, a policy known as hold harmless.
There have to be some changes in the funding formula. I mean, it's not right, and I think this hold harmless, you know, situation is a total mess, and we have to clean this stuff up. And the problem is nobody up here wants to do any heavy lifting because they all want to get reelected.
Now, his campaign says the current use of the formula is working just fine. And so as Election Day nears, there's a lot of noise about education funding. But at least on this point, both candidates are now saying the same thing publicly. No school district will be cut. I'm Kevin McCrory.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron, Keystone Crossroads.
And there's another sign it's election season in Pennsylvania. President Donald Trump is coming to Luzerne County in the northeastern part of the state for a rally tomorrow evening. That county helped deliver Pennsylvania to Trump in 2016, and the president hopes it'll do the same for Republican U.S. Senate candidate Lou Barletta, running to unseat Bob Casey. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, Republicans in the city of Wilkes-Barre say their support of the president has not wavered over the past 18 months.
The president's visiting this small working-class valley community overlooked by the Pocono Mountains to endorse Lou Barletta. Former Hazleton mayor and current congressman, Barletta is trying to unseat Democratic Senator Bob Casey. Casey has a much larger campaign war chest, and polls are strongly favoring the Democrat, but that doesn't faze longtime Wilkes-Barre Republican activist Lynette Villano.
Are they the same polls that said that Hillary was going to win?
In the 2016 primary, Luzerne County Republicans had the highest Trump voting percentage in all of Pennsylvania.
We got Donald Trump elected. Now we need to get the people elected that are going to go there to support his agenda. And that's why this visit tomorrow is so important.
The usually quiet town of 40,000 is buzzing about Trump's visit. And skepticism of voter polling and the media's treatment of the president is heard on almost every corner. In a front-page story on the Wilkes-Barre Times Leader, Barletta is quoted as saying, "Don't trust the, quote, political experts." It's a message that resonates from parts of Wilkes-Barre to the outskirts of northeastern Pennsylvania, like at Maggie's Tavern. It's a biker bar and a gathering spot for local Trump supporters. As I'm hanging out outside the bar, a forest green minivan drives up. Behind the wheel is Bob Cassaro. He goes by Cisco. And he has to take a call before he finishes his interview with me.
Yeah. Hello. I'm at Maggie's right now.
Cisco's a retired construction worker, and he says the press is too hard on Trump.
A bunch of propaganda stuff, you know what I'm saying. Everybody's trying to put him down. Leave him alone. Let him do his thing. That's what I'm thinking.
The issue closest to Cisco's heart is border security. He says he's hoping Trump makes good on his plan to build a wall along the border with Mexico.
You know, we got enough of them over here already.
Who's them? What do you mean?
The import people. You know, they're working for nothing under the tables and stuff. They're taking away our jobs, our money.
Cisco and his friend George Bobchick are planning to go to Trump's rally in Wilkes-Barre tomorrow. The two met a decade ago through a local Harley-Davidson club. Bobchick is a Navy veteran and a trucker.
I think us in Pennsylvania, we're kind of small town compared to the big cities. You got a problem on the East Coast, you got a problem on the West Coast, and of course, California. The people in between, for the most part, they understand President Trump.
Despite that, Bobchick says there is something about Trump's East Coast upbringing that actually appeals to him.
And because he's got tough New York rhetoric that he talks, a lot of people are shocked by that. I love it.
Bobchick is thrilled with Trump's performance in office. He mentions the president's tax cuts, new tariffs, and crackdown on illegal immigration as his favorite policies. He says many rural Pennsylvanians are removed from international affairs, but Trump's recent meeting with Vladimir Putin impressed him and many of his friends.
If you want to negotiate, you don't go in there and, you know, yell at the guy and tell him what a bad dude he is. You go over there and you sit and you make nice and you negotiate. Well, maybe we can get something out of that.
Not far from Maggie's, I find Jeremy Linz, a 33-year-old appliance repairman who links increased business he's seeing with Trump's economic policies. Linz says the working-class vote was underestimated in 2016 and will likely be again in November.
Because we're silent. Because I'm too busy working and worrying about my everyday life to worry about politics. So you might not hear from me about it until it's time.
Back in Wilkes-Barre, as city planners prepare for the big visit, Republican activist Villano says she proudly wears her Trump pin everywhere she goes to let people know it's okay to support him. She says even in northeastern Pennsylvania, she gets talked down to for believing in the president.
And it's wonderful because it does give people the opportunity to say, oh, a Trump supporter, somebody I could talk to. Because sometimes they are made to feel like, you know, they're uneducated. You don't know what you're talking about.
Villano says a major reason for that is harsh media coverage. She thinks most news outlets are overly critical.
So considering that, and he's still as popular as he is, people obviously aren't listening to mainstream media.
But the many who can't get into Trump's rally tomorrow will be tuning in, she says, to watch the president campaign for Barletta, who many Republicans here say was Trumpian before the now president had even won a primary. Bobby Allen, WHYY News, Wilkes-Barre.
In 2015, a bipartisan Blue Ribbon Study Panel on Biodefense issued a national blueprint, subtitled Leadership and Major Reform Needed to Optimize Efforts. Let's look at those efforts 3 years on with panel co-chair Tom Ridge, former Pennsylvania Republican governor and the first U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security from 2003 to 2005. Governor Ridge, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
My great pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
Also here with us is fellow panel member Jim Greenwood, a former six-term Pennsylvania Republican congressman and then appointed president and CEO of the Biotechnology Industry Organization. Congressman Greenwood, thanks for being here as well.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate that.
When we talk about biodefense, are we referring to primarily acts of terrorism or pandemics or both?
Well, we know that our adversaries have built bioweapons. We know that the terrorists, if they had the opportunity to access them, would use them. And we also know that Mother Nature has a very intriguing laboratory and that there are hundreds of thousands of viruses out there that could mutate naturally. So this study, which is bipartisan, Donna Shalala, former Democrat Secretary of HHS, former Minority Leader Tom Daschle, Joe Lieberman, we've concluded that we are ill-prepared whether the terrorists throw it at us or Mother Nature throws it at us.
The blueprint issued dozens of recommendations. Are we any better prepared in 2018 than we were in 2015?
Well, I have to sadly say we're no better prepared now, but I would also optimistically say we've done the work for the Congress, we've prepared the set of recommendations, and we now have them in legislative form. So we're working very hard to get as many of those proposals into the law and possibly even this year.
In terms of prioritizing, which biological threats put the country at greatest risk?
If you took a poll of the panelists as well as the experts, they wouldn't focus on any particular one. They would talk more importantly about those that could be either mutated and developed by these countries or the terrorist or by Mother Nature. But I'll also give you an example. When I was first in the White House, I was shown a list of pathogens that we were fearful that even the terrorists might use. One happened to be Ebola. Fast forward 12 or 13 years later, and you see how we scrambled when the first case of Ebola was reported overseas. Point of fact is we had over a decade to prepare for it when our intelligence community said it's out there and we weren't prepared. We are just not prepared. And we need leadership. You need priorities. You probably need less political appointees and more focus.
Quite frankly, in 2018, do you feel we have the leadership in place to execute these plans?
As this issue has evolved over the decades, there's been developed 50 different agencies in the federal government that have some role to play. And you know how that works. If you have 50 people in charge, you have no one in charge. And so our number one recommendation was that we center the leadership at the office of the vice president. I think the vice president has the stature and the visibility to really lead and organize the entire effort.
Governor Ridge, your 2009 book, Test of Our Times, refers to your time as head of the Department of Homeland Security. Is this an equally profound test of our times in this regard?
It's a test of our times in terms of risk mitigation. The 21st century world is full of risk. One of the reasons is because of the forces of globalization. Millions of people, trains, planes, and automobiles come across our borders every year. And we do know that countries that have even signed treaties not to use biological weapons are still building them. And we know terrorists said if they could get access, they would use them. So you have to just simply accept that reality and deal with it in a responsible way.
Well, then lastly, I'd like to hear from each of you in turn whether you have cause for short and or long-term optimism in this case.
Yes, Jim Greenwood speaking here. I am optimistic, and we're hoping now that we've provided the tools and the directions and the recommendations to Congress that they'll take these recommendations to heart and get this into law by the end of the year.
The fact of the matter is that there are legitimate public policy disputes about a wide range of issues. We agreed, the panel agreed, I mean, you got strong R's and strong D's on the panel. There should be no dispute as to one, is the threat real? It is. There should be no dispute to conclude that we're ill-prepared, because people on both sides of the aisle and experts have said that. And frankly, we took a long look at the kind of recommendations we'd offered to try to facilitate their passage. So I'm going to be optimistic, and hopefully if we have this conversation 6 months or a year from now, we can tell you that most of them have been passed. So stay tuned.
I suspect the definition of a strong R and a strong D has certainly evolved since your times in office, but we'll leave that for a separate conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having us.
Great pleasure being with you. Thank you very much.
Former Pennsylvania Governor and former U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security Tom Ridge and former Pennsylvania Congressman Jim Greenwood, members of a bipartisan blue ribbon panel on biodefense. Philadelphia's district attorney has taken heat from families of crime victims who say staffers don't keep them in the loop as cases develop. Now, DA Larry Krasner has secured a $1 million grant to provide counseling services to the families of homicide victims. Details from WHYY's Tom McDonald.
Once a family experiences homicide, you can never take that family back to before that homicide occurred.
Movita Johnson-Harrell is supervisor of the DA's Office Victim Witness Services and also lost her 18-year-old son to homicide. She says the new program, which will be known as Philadelphia Cares, is designed to offer special services to families who lose a member to homicide.
In most instances, families are unable to concentrate or read or make decisions effectively, and this team will become the brain for this family. This team will assist with funeral arrangements, case management assessments, any need that this family may have for the first 45 days after the homicide occurs.
Rafika Sanders and 11 other people working in the program lost family members to violence. If she's notifying a family when someone was killed, she says it will be easier giving the bad news from someone who has dealt with the same thing.
This initiative that's going on in Philadelphia is so needed, because I should not have to walk alone in my journey that I did. That was, and it's still hard for me to go through it, but it's a journey that I know I have to go through. But the initial trauma that I went through, I wish I had this program.
DA Larry Krasner says he's excited about the program, which is being billed as a first of its kind to offer a safety net of services to crime victims' families around the clock.
It's a big deal because no organization in the city currently provides a cooperative crisis response system and a comprehensive portfolio of services to crime victims. It's a big deal because in my career of now a little bit over 30 years, I've never seen a system like this in Philadelphia County.
The program's expected to be up and running shortly after Labor Day. Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
This week's announced sale of the Oyster Creek Nuclear Power Plant in Lacey Township, New Jersey, could accelerate the decommissioning process. Helping us make sense of this action is Christina Simeone, Director of Policy and External Affairs at Penn's Kleinman Center for Energy Policy. Christina, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Now, let's note that the plant is still operational through next month. Mm-hmm. So what does this week's announcement mean?
So this is basically pertains to the strategy of how to decontaminate the site once the operations cease. Basically, what was announced today is that the plant owner, Exelon, has sold the plant to another company, Holtec. And that second company, Holtec, will be responsible for decontaminating the site.
But it's the rate of contaminating that's the issue here, where Exelon once said it would take 60-plus years. The new concern says they can do it in, what, 8?
Right. And actually, this is a very good thing. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission gives plant licensees up to 60 years to complete decommissioning. This new company said it can decommission the plant in only 8 years, which is a much better outcome. Now, one of the reasons that is because, say, for example, Exelon, their core business is running plants, not decommissioning plants. This new venture by Holtec is focused on decommissioning plants.
Why don't we take this juncture to explain the decommissioning process?
Sure. So the decommissioning, again, involves decontamination of the site, dismantling of the equipment, and disposing of the radioactive materials. There's two types of radioactive materials you want to be concerned about. In general, low-level radioactive waste and high-level radioactive waste. The high-level radioactive waste is the spent fuel, the fuel that was used to produce power. And that turns out that's a very small volume of waste generated at this plant. So the large amount is low-level waste, which can be cleaned and moved off-site. There are disposal sites in Clive, Utah, and in other places, Andrews, Texas, where this waste can be disposed of. But for the high-level waste, we really don't have a national strategy for disposal. Interestingly enough, Holtec also has an application pending to serve as an interim storage facility for high-level radioactive waste in New Mexico.
Now, where you earlier said this is a good thing, I'm not sure that view is universally held, certainly by some environmentalists who are concerned about the shipping off of these materials and the potential danger therein.
I would separate the issue of decommissioning the site from the issue of long-term management of the high-level waste. Really need to separate those two issues. Decommissioning will happen. The high-level waste will stay at an independent spent fuel storage installation on site at Oyster Creek indefinitely until either Holtec's disposal facility in New Mexico is approved or until the federal government opens an alternative.
Are there examples that come to mind where a decommissioning process goes awry?
Can't think of one offhand where there's a safety issue. I can think of examples where the costs exceed what was expected. So the contamination on site, perhaps soil contamination, was more extensive than anticipated, and it became far more expensive to decontaminate the site than originally expected.
Are those costs ultimately borne by the energy consumer?
Well, there is a decommissioning trust fund established, and there is one for Oyster Creek. And I believe in this business scenario, Holtec takes the risk. If they can clean the site for less than what's in the decommissioning trust fund, then they keep the rest, and that's their profit. If they have a cost overrun, then that's on them. That's my current understanding of how it would work.
Christina, thanks so much for coming in to explain.
Wonderful. Thanks for having me, Dave.
Christina Simeone, Director of Policy and External Affairs at Penn's Kleinman Center for Energy Policy. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.